For another perspective on current patterns of care in prostate cancer, I met with Dr. Richard Stock, whose landmark research on brachytherapy of prostate cancer with Dr. Nelson Stone has resulted in a clinical database with some of the longest available follow-up. Dr. Stock began our conversation by providing an overview of this work.
We started treating patients with prostate brachytherapy in 1990, and now we have 15 or 16 years of data. We've put a lot of effort into trying to track down as many patients that we've treated over time to see how they've done. So I think it's more of a maturation of the data set that's really what's been new and really showing that the outcomes that we observed earlier on have held up with time. And that's been very rewarding. What we've seen is that a lot of the early and late radiation side effects we've seen manifesting and usually within the first 5 years of therapy. And with longer follow-up, we haven't really seen any new or any startling kind of new types of late side effects, which is good, which means that patients in the long term are doing very well with brachytherapy as a treatment for prostate cancer. So those are some of the things we've been looking at and how patients do, how is their urinary function, incontinence rates, preservation of potency. And we found that that's holding up with time in terms of what you get after about 5 years. It's kind of stayed with the patients. They haven't had any new side effects developing with longer follow-up. And the same can be said with the cancer control rate. We found that a lot of the patients that have failed treatment in terms of having a biochemical recurrence do so within the first 5 years. And there are very few new or late recurrences of the cancer with longer follow-up. Our results show around the 90 to 95% biochemical control rate out to about 10 years. In terms of preservation of sexual function, that's also been maintained, and it's kind of supported our earlier publications on potency preservation, where we're seeing that overall about 60% of patients that come into brachytherapy potent maintain some form of potency. But what's interesting, what we're beginning to notice with longer follow-up and a treatment of younger patients, is that younger patients particularly are doing extremely well, and their preservation of potency is more in the range of about 90%. So that's kind of some of the newer findings that we're seeing. We don't have a data set to kind of compare in terms of our radical or external beam, so it's hard to compare, really, as I said earlier, unless you're doing a trial, but at least these outcomes compared to the best centers seem to compare nicely.
What about the patient with intermediate and high-risk disease?
Again, they're doing very well. Again, we've always tried to customize the therapy, so an implant alone has been primarily our treatment for low-risk patients. Intermediate and high-risk, we've treated in different ways with an implant combined with external beam, an implant combined with neoadjuvant adjuvant hormonal therapy, or for our high-risk patients, a combined approach that involves both hormonal therapy and implant and external beam. And that's kind of the approaches we've taken, where our outcomes have still been quite excellent. So what we're particularly proud of is the combined approach using 9 months of hormone therapy, radioactive seed implant, and external beam radiation therapy. And recent analyses show that at about 8 years, which is basically as long as we have decent amount of follow-up, we're running at about 80% biochemical control rate for high-risk patients, which has been pretty impressive. And for our intermediate-risk patients, which we've treated with different types of modalities, we're really running in the high 80s, low 90s biochemical control rate out by 10 years using either an implant in hormones or an implant in external beam.
Can you talk about some of your current ongoing clinical research efforts?
Well, we've tried to focus a little bit more on toxicities now, and so we do have some trials looking at prophylactic use of Viagra to perhaps improve some of the impotency associated with hormone therapy or impotency associated with brachytherapy. So we have some trials that are either just started or will be starting soon looking at prophylactic Viagra use. We've had some preliminary outcome using neoadjuvant and adjuvant chemotherapy in our high-risk patients. But what I'm particularly excited about is that we're really kind of branching out into translational research, and we're beginning to establish a genetic repository for our patients by sampling their blood. And what we're looking at particularly, and we've done some work at, is the genetic susceptibility to radiation, because we believe that not all patients respond to radiation in the same way. So some patients may be more susceptible, more prone to side effects, and others may be more resistant. And then that's the first line that we've been looking at, but we also feel that there's something else that we would like to study, which is why certain patients respond so well to treatment and others are very resistant to some of the treatments that have been successful for us. And we think a lot of it lies in the genetic makeup of the patient. One of the things that we've looked at, and specifically at radiosensitivity, is genetic mutations for the ATM gene, ataxia telangiectasia mutation. So having the disease makes someone extremely susceptible to any UV radiation from light outside, from the sunlight. But we find the patients that may carry one or more of the mutations associated with the gene are prone to be susceptible to some of the side effects of radiation. This is something that we found both in breast cancer patients, women with breast cancer, who are particularly susceptible to some of the radiation late side effects. And we've begun to see that in even some of the radiation side effects associated with brachytherapy, such as impotency and rectal bleeding. And so that's some of the things that we've published recently on, but we're now beginning to explore some of the other genes, perhaps, that are associated with radiation repair mechanisms.
What are some of the clinical research reports that have come out in the last couple of years that you think are important for radiation oncologists and urologists to know about?
Well, I think still some of the most important things that we have seen in radiation therapy in general have been the RTOG studies, also some prospective randomized studies that look at the use of hormone therapy and external beam radiation therapy. And so to me, some of the most important trials now that we have, they're published, are RTOG 9202 and the EORTC trial, which looked at long-term hormone therapy for high-risk patients. And when you really look at all of the RTOG trials, the RTOG 9210, which used 2 years of hormone therapy with external beam radiation therapy, that result really shows the best biochemical control rates for high-risk patients. So in my opinion, I think that it's really saying something that really can perhaps treat microscopic metastatic disease in many of these high-risk patients with long-term hormone therapy. So I'm excited by that, and we're looking at our own data set to kind of combine our very, very high-risk patients with a combined approach using our very successful approach of an implant and external beam, but trying to combine it with longer-term hormone therapy, kind of extrapolating from the very positive outcomes from both the RTOG and the EORTC trials.
Can you talk about some of the research that's come out looking at post-prostatectomy radiation therapy?
Well, there's a recent publication, again, from the EORTC that looked at the effect of using post-op radiation therapy for patients after radical prostatectomy. And what the study has shown is that there seems to be an improvement in most of the endpoints, although it's too early to look at survival. So it was a very positive study supporting the use of post-operative RT. And I believe there is a recent abstract from SWOG confirming this type of positive benefit for using post-op RT following radical prostatectomy.
Can you talk about how you approach that decision in your own practice?
In my practice, when I see a patient who's had a radical prostatectomy, I specifically look very carefully at the radical prostatectomy specimen, whether there's been a positive margin, involvement of the seminal vesicles, whether the patient has a residual PSA. And these are all factors that I consider when deciding whether a patient is a good candidate. And in my opinion, any patient that has a positive margin, any patient that has disease that's through the capsule spreading into the seminal vesicles, is at extremely high risk of developing a local recurrence. And when you look at the radical prostatectomy data, it clearly supports a local failure component in these patients. And so it makes a lot of sense, just like we do with breast cancer and other sites of the body, to give postoperative radiation therapy. There has been some reluctance in the past, but I'm hoping that with these recent trials, many urologists will reconsider this. And I think with the new radiation therapy technologies, such as intensity-modulated radiation therapy and image-guided radiation therapy, we're really able to deliver this radiation very, very safely and spare the bladder and the rectum. And so there's really, in my opinion, very little downside to giving these patients treatment and a lot of upside in terms of the ability to control them by treating them relatively early. There is always a risk of having some radiation cystitis or some radiation proctitis. But again, with the newer modalities, I found this to be a very, very low risk. I don't think it really adds much to the impotency. I think that a lot of the impotency that is seen after radical is seen within the first few months. And in my experience, the radiation that we deliver doesn't really add on to that. I think if a patient comes in already having significant potency problems due to the surgery, obviously the radiation therapy is not going to make it better, but I don't think it's going to make it substantially worse.
Can you talk a little bit about how you follow the PSA after brachytherapy and other forms of radiation therapy and what you see and how you react to changes in PSA?
With brachytherapy, because when you do a brachytherapy procedure, so for instance, iodine-125, you're placing these radioactive seeds in the prostate, they will give off radiation over about an 8-month period of time. And so a couple of things are important to know when you're following a patient. One is that it's going to take this long for the full therapy to be delivered. And the other thing is that radiation works by damaging the DNA. So the radiation from either a seed implant or external beam may damage the DNA of cells, but those cells, even though they are genetically damaged, still may make PSA. They still may make the PSA protein. And so it can take many years for the PSA following brachytherapy, for instance, to hit its nadir or its lowest point, and that could be 4 or 5 years. So I think it's very important to follow these patients very carefully, but at the same time, not to jump to any conclusions, because what we also know is that because these cells are still making PSA, and because brachytherapy can be associated with some late inflammatory reactions, that you can see transient elevations in PSA during the follow-up period. So people have termed this a PSA bounce or PSA spike. It's something that we see in about 30% of patients. And what's interesting is we see it more commonly in very good quality implants, the ones that we like to practice and that I think most of us are able to achieve now. And we see it more commonly in young men, which we're treating more of. So it's very important in a young man that you're treating to know that if a PSA goes up once or even twice, you can't jump to a conclusion, immediately start the patient on hormone therapy. You have to be patient and wait it out, because in many cases and many times these PSAs will go back down. And in terms of waiting for the lowest level, that may take 4 to 5 years.
What do you see in terms of the nadir of PSA with implants versus external beam?
Well, I think there is a difference. I think most of the patients that we treat with brachytherapy implants nadir around a level of 0.1 or less. With external beam, when you cure a patient, and there's no evidence of biochemical recurrence, you still are seeing PSAs typically in the range of about 0.5 to 1. So I think there is a significant difference. I think it points to a biologic difference in terms of the biologic effective dose between an implant and external beam radiation therapy. And I think it really points to us that an implant will deliver a higher biologically effective dose than you can get with external beam at current doses that are being delivered.
You talked about high-quality implants. What defines a high-quality implant?
Well, one of the things we look at is the dose delivered to the prostate, and there's many ways of looking at it. And one of the things that we've done is look at the dose by reconstructing the prostate and doing something called the dose volume histogram, which is really looking at the whole prostate as a volume and doses delivered to percentages of that volume. And some of our early work at Mount Sinai was to define the D90, which is the dose to 90% of the gland. And then most people now appreciate that as kind of a very good way of describing the dose delivered to the prostate. And so that's one of the ways, one of the parameters, the dosing parameters that are used to look at what's considered a good quality implant. And what we think, for instance, for iodine is that you need to have doses or D90s that are over 140 gray. And for palladium, it's probably doses that are over 110 gray. And so these are the types of things that we're beginning to look at. And when I talk about quality implants, that's really what I'm referring to. Urologists are still concerned about the long-term outcomes. They're concerned about late recurrences. I don't think radiation oncologists that do it are as concerned as much, because we see the results. But that's often, when I speak to urologists, some of the common concerns about, even though we've been doing this now, people are having data approaching 15 years, it's still a very commonly asked question and concern from urologists. From radiation oncologists, I think many of them are looking at brachytherapy and perhaps comparing it to external beam. And so many of them are concerned with maybe perhaps the urinary symptoms that you get after brachytherapy, comparing it with newer modalities of external beam. And so a lot of times, especially when speaking to radiation oncologists, I focus on the importance of the technique of implantation in reducing the morbidity commonly associated with it. So I think radiation oncologists are concerned about morbidity, concerned about ways of reducing it. And there's been a lot of focus within the radiation oncology community on trying to reduce the morbidity.
What are some of the technique pitfalls, so to speak, or areas that you think can be improved?
Well, there are a lot of different techniques to do prostate brachytherapy. The one that we've kind of pioneered and we feel very strongly about is a real-time intraoperative technique, where we're doing all of our work with the aid of a computer in the operating room at the time of the procedure. And we emphasize peripheral loading. That's by putting most of our seeds around the outside in the periphery of the prostate, as opposed to loading radioactive seeds in the inside of the prostate. And this is a technique that can reduce very high doses of radiation to the urethra. And I think that will reduce the urinary side effects that we see. In addition, because we have an intraoperative computer, a computer that aids us in the placement of the seeds and the needles during the procedure, we're able to control more carefully the dose that the seeds give to the rectum. And by controlling that dose and reducing that dose, we will reduce late radiation side effects such as proctitis.
I'm curious how many implants you yourself do a year and what you think the number of implants is that a radiation oncologist sort of needs to do to sort of stay in the flow of excellence.
We do about 250 cases per year currently. It changes from year to year. Some years it's more, some is less. I think what's happened, though, is it was a kind of a rev-up period, and interest grew probably around 1995 to 1997. Our numbers continue to grow. And then I think what happened, which is pretty natural, is that more and more people began to learn how to do this. And then obviously more people are doing it. And so it's very hard to totally dominate any particular geographic market, I think, because most radiation oncologists and urologists are involved in brachytherapy. To answer your question about the numbers that I think are needed, I think it's hard to say one number per year, but certainly I think one would need to probably do at least 50 cases per year and over a number of years to really develop a certain competence in the procedure.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach the patient who has PSA progression?
I think this is a very interesting topic and one that I think deserves a lot of our attention, because I think what we're beginning to learn is that not all PSA progressions require treatment. And so when I see a patient that has a PSA rise after brachytherapy, what I first do is want to make sure that this is real. And so I'll have the patient return for multiple follow-up visits to really document that it's not one or two, but usually at least four or five consecutive elevations, and usually with spacing at least 3 months apart. That signals to me that probably there's a very good chance something is going on. What I like to do then is kind of restage the patient. And even if the PSA is low, I usually get another CAT scan and a bone scan just to rule out any obvious disease recurrence. And then typically what we do for brachytherapy is we have the patient undergo a repeat biopsy of their prostate and seminal vesicles to make sure that there hasn't been cancer that has just been resilient to the effects of the brachytherapy or seed implant. And so those are the steps that we take. At that point, once we have all that information, then we really discuss with the patient what's the appropriate way to go. And that's when I think it's important to factor in the PSA doubling time. Since we've had five or six PSAs, we can extrapolate that data out and look at how fast is that PSA doubling. And there is now very convincing data from the Johns Hopkins group, as well as some of the multi-institutional trials, that doubling time is very important and does predict for distant metastases and death from prostate cancer. So there are different cut points that are being used, but certainly an important one is doubling times less than 10 months. I think to us signal that this patient, if not treated, is going to be in trouble. And so there are certain cut points. Obviously, doubling times less than 6 months, it's a very ominous sign. It means that this is very aggressive cancer that I believe requires immediate and very aggressive therapy. On the other hand, if you see a patient who you do all the workup and all the workup is negative and their doubling time is 3 years, I'd be very comfortable just watching that patient without any further intervention.
How do you approach the patient with PSA progression after radical prostatectomy?
Well, again, initially I will look at the pathology from the radical prostatectomy and really focus on this. So what we know is that if a patient has a positive margin, those patients do well, actually, after radiation therapy. And if you're treating a patient perhaps because they have a PSA that's going up, but the margins are all negative, actually, those patients don't do as well. You think they would do better, but they don't do as well. It's because they probably have systemic disease and the local therapy, the radiation therapy, is not going to work well. So after looking at the patient's PSA, looking at their surgical specimen, I then look at the PSA. Then I'll also factor in doubling time. So if I see a patient who has a very high-grade cancer, a Gleason score of 8, 9, or 10, with multiple positive margins, involvement in the seminal vesicle, and a very, very short doubling time, that patient is such a high risk of having systemic disease that I probably would not offer that patient local therapy. Or I would walk for them local therapy with immediate, you know, androgen withdrawal therapy or androgen suppression therapy.
Any new advances in terms of the technical delivery of radiation therapy that you think are going to be important?
Well, I think we have made some good strides with intensity modulated radiation therapy. I think the next way people are in it is image-guided radiation therapy by using markers to track the prostate. We have done that. We have an image-guided radiation system that enables us to track the prostate on a daily basis to take into account prostate motion. So from a radiation therapy standpoint, in my opinion, has been a major advance in really delivering the exact dose that you want to the prostate on a day-to-day basis. And I think in the long term, patients are going to greatly benefit from that type of enhanced imaging quality that we're seeing with radiation therapy.
What about the issue of trying to identify patients who can be followed with watchful waiting? It's a very vexing situation. You have more and more patients diagnosed with unfavorable disease, younger patients who don't want to undergo the morbidity, although hopefully it's not going to be that great of therapy. Where are we in terms of being able to separate this out?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the work done from kind of retrospective studies looking at PSA velocity, both pre-treatment and post-treatment, is very telling, and I find it very useful in my practice. I happen to have just seen a man who was 48, and everyone told him he needed therapy. But he happened to have a biopsy almost by coincidence, and with a PSA of 0.9 and a Gleason score of 6 with no palpable disease, I figured this guy, had he not seen a urologist for whatever reason it was, may never have been diagnosed with prostate cancer, or have been diagnosed 10 years from now when he was 58. So those patients, I feel very comfortable in watching them, especially when we have a valuable tool as PSA. People have kind of poo-pooed PSA recently. But I think looking at not just absolute levels of PSA, but looking at changes in PSA over time is still very, very important. And I think it will enable us to be able to say, okay, we're going to feel comfortable watching you and safely by tracking your PSA at regular intervals. And then another patient, we maybe see early on rapid PSA elevations, which then signal to us that this is not really an ideal candidate for watchful waiting. This, again, I believe, along with, which we don't have now, looking at the genetics of patients, is going to really help us determine which patients need to be treated and which patients don't. What's been interesting to us is that we are still not there in terms of optimizing the local control of disease, especially for high-risk patients. And I think that has been, in many ways, neglected. And I think it's extremely important, even in patients who had a very high risk of having systemic disease, to optimize their local control. In some of our analysis, what we've found is by giving a very aggressive radiation treatment with an implant and external beam, we've effectively eradicated the local disease, and we've actually shifted the patterns of failure for these patients. It's really quite interesting. So when you look at some of the more, I call them old radiation therapy series, using more primitive techniques, there's a very big difference between the percentage of patients that have biochemical failure and those that have distant metastases. So you might have, by 10 years, 60% of the patients having a rising PSA, but by 10 years, only 10% of those patients have developed distant metastases. So there's a big difference. With our series, since we've optimized the local therapy, we find that in high-risk patients, when their PSA goes up, they're very likely to develop distant metastases of disease. So by optimizing the local control, we've kind of shifted the patterns of failure to one that's almost pure distant failure, as opposed to the older RTOG trials, where you see a lot of these patients with high PSA recurrence rates, and a big difference between their PSA recurrence rates and their distant rates, suggesting that those patients have a very high component of local failure. And so within the first 10 years, they're not going to develop distant metastases. But now that patients are living longer and we're detecting it, this is going to become more and more important, because those patients who fail locally and now are out 15 and 20 years, those patients will probably develop distant metastases down the road. So I think we really need to, again, focus on the importance not only in developing these new agents to control disease when it's metastasized, but to optimize a local therapy.